Welcome to Betrayal Recovery Radio, the official podcast of APSATS, the Association of Partners of Sex Addict Trauma Specialists, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. APSATS is a nonprofit organization providing professional training and compassionate support to partners affected by problematic sexual behavior and betrayal trauma. In each episode, Dr. Jake guides a conversation of enlightening insights and practical tools to empower those affected by sex addiction and betrayal trauma to use their voices and live their values. The mission of Betrayal Recovery Radio is to offer hope to those in need of healing and growth to those moving through grief. And now, here's your host, Dr. Jake Porter.
Welcome to this episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio. I am your host, Dr. Jake Porter, and I'm so excited today to share with you a conversation that actually took place earlier this year for the Choose Connection Summit. The Choose Connection Summit is an annual free online event for couples who are walking the journey toward healing from betrayal and sex addiction. And it's something that I put on every year and try to invite colleagues, friends of mine to come on and be a part of it. This year, I was so honored to be joined by Fran Hopwood as we did an interview really in honor of her late husband, Richard Butler. After a career in education, Fran switched from to personal coaching and mentoring in 2017 after walking her own recovery journey from betrayal trauma after discovering sex addiction in her marriage. Fran uses her own experience of the challenges of healing and her professional knowledge and skills to support other partners seeking freedom and growth from the effects of problematic sexual behavior in their relationships. Her passion is working with women affected by betrayal, and it stems not only from being a partner, but also from her experience of two previous marriages affected by infidelity. She's a certified APSATS partner coach. She's a professional partner trauma mentor, and she's a partner group peer facilitator. She's received lots of additional trainings in disclosure preparation from Dan Drake and Janice Cottle. She's been trained in Gottman's work, my couple-centered recovery model, the IRCA model of Carol the Coach. She's a part of the team at the Naked Truth Project in the UK, which is a charity with the mission to open the eyes and free lives from the damaging effects of pornography. Richard, Fran's husband, was committed to helping other men in their recovery, and he also became an ICF-certified coach and professional mentor. He was the first male coach with the Naked Truth Project, and because of his commitment to being partner-sensitive in his approach, became the very first European male to become certified with APSATS. Very sadly, to the whole APSATS community, Richard died on the 29th of August of 2022 after a short illness. Fran and Richard really have been some of the warmest, dearest people that I've met professionally and been able to develop a friendship with. They are an absolute delight. Richard's death really did shake many of us. And so when I asked Fran to have a conversation about their story, about Richard, about his recovery journey and his commitment to the APSATS model and being partner sensitive, I was thrilled when she took me up on that. And so both for this episode and the next, we're going to have a conversation with Fran, and we're going to hear her share about her life and her journey with Richard. Before we turn to that conversation, I do just want to make you all aware about some things coming up with the Association of Partners of Sex Addicts Trauma Specialists, APSATS, who is the fuel behind this podcast. Coming up on July the 7th, our very own president is doing sex addiction abstinence contracts, what partners and those working with partners need to know. That's a one-hour workshop on Friday, July 7th. Then we have a panel discussion on Friday, August the 4th. A one-hour discussion, successful clinician-coach collaboration for betrayed partners. And then on September 1st, another one-hour workshop, The Partner's Role in Couples Work, that will be presented by Kim Hansen Peroni and one of our APSATS certified coaches. Lots of other stuff coming up on the website. Go to APSATS.org to find out more. But I don't want to take up any more time and turn now to my conversation with Fran. Well, hello, Fran. Welcome to the 2023 Choose Connection Summit. I'm so glad you agreed to be a part of this. The truth is I adore you and I adore Richard. And when I had the idea to do this session and really honor him and remember him, I just prayed that you would be on board for it. And it thrilled me when you said yes. So thank you again for being here and doing this. Yeah. So let's just start out. I just want to give you an opportunity to tell us all a little bit about you and Richard as a couple.
Yeah. Okay. We met in our late 30s, to be honest. I went to work in a college where Richard was there and he was my boss. But within a year and a half, I was his boss. So some people say that never changed, you know. I'd been married twice before, and both marriages had ended with betrayal, not through sex addiction, but betrayal.
Wow.
with other women. And I had two children from my second marriage, two daughters. And Richard had been married once before. He had two sons, and his two sons were exactly the same age as my daughters, which was totally coincidental. But we started to work together, and I don't know, there's something sparked off between us in terms of, I think we brought out the best in each other, and we had some really good complementary skills. So we started a small business on the side, a health and safety business. And, you know, he had the skills. He's a bit of a showman and the business acumen. And I have my passion for learning and for really experiential learning, and making creative curriculum was kind of my key thing. So it worked. It worked together. And
so
that kind of.
Yeah. What were the fields that you were in? What were you teaching at the college?
We're both chemists.
I'm sorry.
We're both chemists, but this was health
okay.
and safety. And Richard liked to do the sort of pyromaniac stuff, you know, the demonstration stuff. And I liked the solidity of exercises that gave people real skills, you know, and it worked. It worked. Yeah. But
okay.
I guess what happened
wow.
is we had this
and
really
so...
good intellectual intimacy, and that turned into a physical intimacy and a level of emotional intimacy. But if I'm honest, our emotional intimacy was limited by me, to be honest, because of the past. Mm. I was, you know, I had to keep myself safe, and we got separate children, and we got separate oldies and separate jobs. And I think I recognized that Richard was not as emotional as my previous partners, but I just assumed it was personality, or, you know, all the skills that he had that I now know were red flags. I saw them as entrepreneurship, busyness, you know, I had other names for them that meant I didn't see them as anything that was a red flag.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And so a relationship was born, and then what?
Then we moved in together. Richard was keen on getting married. I didn't want to do that. I'd done it twice. It hadn't worked. So we lived together for 12 years. And I guess our relationship was in three parts. It was like the busy years, you know, when the children were young, the oldies were around. And then we had these middle years when our careers started to diverge, and we became empty nesters, and we became orphans, and we were approaching retirement and had all these dreams about what that was going to be. But the reality was, when that happened, we both kind of escaped into work, and I started to recognize this deep disconnection. And that was the time the addiction started, which I guess was mainly down to broadband. But there had also been in the UK a big sexual abuse investigation at that time to do with a disc jockey, Jimmy Savile. You know, it was big news. And I have a feeling that awoke something in him, and that and the internet was enough to start off things that had been suppressed for years, and things I knew nothing about. We never talked about.
Wow.
So,
wow. And so I'm thinking, is this like in the late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, this would have been late 90s, late 90s. Yeah. And so, and then there was 2013, which was D-Day. So that was like stage three of the relationship, D-Day and beyond. Yeah.
Okay. Just as much as you might want to, can you share a little bit about your D-Day?
Yeah. I guess, the initial D-Day, all I found was some emails to another woman. And but that was enough for me. You know, with my history, I just completely flipped. I couldn't believe it was happening again. You know, this, it's like lightning striking three times. And something in me told me that this was, I didn't believe that Richard didn't care about me. I just didn't believe that. So I knew it was a tip of the iceberg. And I went into massive hypervigilance. And he went into absolute, solid, stalwart denial. Whatever I asked, he lied, wow. He minimized, he omitted. But, you know, forensically, I was into bank accounts, I was into phone records, I was into emails, I was into everything. And drip by drip by drip, different information came out, and I realized that this was massive, that it was much bigger, that it involved acting out with other people, but passively, almost what I called passively, and that kind of made it okay until... I don't know. I think at that point, maybe it was a God thing. You know, we didn't have a spiritual connection at that time at all. But I think it was a God thing that one day I just got this word sex addiction in my head because nothing else made sense. Nothing else made sense. And I didn't even know what it was, you know.
Wow.
But we looked on the internet. Well, I looked on the internet, sat him down, and we went through one of these surveys. And that's when I learned there was porn at the back of it. And I just couldn't believe that. That just didn't make any sense either. And then I realized that we were dealing with something that was much, much bigger than we could cope with on our own.
Wow. Well, you know, hearing you describe Richard as, you know, defensive and in denial and stonewalling, he was a different man by the time I met him. And so I have a hard time picturing that. I do. I have a very difficult time imagining that. So let, you know, that drip, 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 that little by little finding out more and more, discovering more and more, that's clearly a major obstacle and a major wound from those early days. What other major obstacles in the early days of recovery did you and Richard encounter?
I think it was my isolation, really. I, you know, once I'd got this label, he felt this big shame, but I just felt shame too. I didn't want anyone to know. I didn't want to tell anyone. I didn't want anyone to judge me for staying. I didn't want anyone to judge him. It just felt like something that was too horrible to talk about. And besides, I'd done nothing wrong. So I didn't need any kind of fixing. But once I realized that Richard had crossed the bottom line, if you like, that what I thought was my bottom line boundary, although I didn't have that language then, obviously. Once we'd crossed that, I just went into shock. And to be honest, he didn't tell me that, and he tricked himself into having to tell me that truth. Because that happened after we booked a disclosure and he knew he was going to have a polygraph.
Uh-huh.
But I just went into total shock, even though I'd been expecting it, and started to shake and just lost the ability to speak and talk and ended up in hospital, which was horrible, being taken by ambulance, and he wasn't allowed in the ambulance. But it was the first time I told my story to anybody. And I spent the night with two mental health nurses. They just wanted to make sure I wasn't a danger to myself. And they told me I'd got PTSD. And a doctor came in and saw me, and he said, you need support. You need some medication. You need something to help you. And it made the a big difference to me, because I came out of there and I had a diagnosis. I had, okay, so the reasons I'm behaving as I am are because something has happened to me. And all those behaviors, I'm not crazy. They're just things that I'm doing to find safety. And I got some medical help from some things to help me sleep and calm me down a little bit. And that was sort of the beginning of being really rational about how we were going to deal with this, you know.
Okay.
We didn't know what kind of help to get at all. And in the UK, it's not that easy. We had the first therapist that Richard had, we had two disclosures with her. They were nothing like a therapeutic disclosure. And I got about 10% of the information. But she said, wow. Well, he'd been sober for 3 months. He went into immediate sobriety. So as far as she was concerned, 3 months, he was cured. But this was during the time we were still getting this drip, 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 you know. And by then I'd started to research stuff wider than the UK. And I found Milton Magnus. And I just said to Richard, you have a choice. If you want this marriage to work, this is what we're going to do. I don't care what it costs. But I'm not going to push you. I'm not your controller. It's up to you. And the next day he went ahead and booked it. So it was what our retirement funds went on, really.
Oh, wow. And you came here to Houston, to my hometown.
We came to Houston, to your hometown. We did the 3-day, you know, everything before the present, the polygraph, and then the how do we move forward? And I have to say, by then, Richard was able to tell the whole truth. He passed the polygraph with flying colors. And pretty soon afterwards, we went to a couple's retreat with Milton and his wife and five or six other couples. And, you know, it was almost like going from the crisis stage to the rebuilding stage without doing any of that grief work in the middle. But it was an exciting thing to do, to go and do that and to see other couples.
Did you do that on the same trip?
No, we came home.
Was
and went
that
back
on the same trip?
Later. Okay. No.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And, okay. Wow.
Going home, we had to find a new, we decided that Richard would use the same therapist as I was using. And so we both had the same person, but we'd made a decision that we would tell each other everything anyway. I couldn't have any more secrets. I didn't want any more secrets. But I think one of the biggest obstacles was Richard just regressed. He just went into a childhood state, you know. If I was to ask him any questions or if we tried to talk about things, he would get small and his voice would go up and he would scratch his arms and shield his head like this. And it just didn't seem right to me that was going on, you know. That was how I knew that there was something behind in his past. And, you know, luckily we were able to draw that out before going to see Milton. And that was that was pretty hard. But I suppose in a sense, it gave me the compassion that I was looking for what he was going through. Yeah.
Mm, wow. You knew something of the reason. Which is not an excuse. There's a difference between a reason and an excuse. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It felt none of the rest of it made sense. Oh.
Yeah. Yes. Well, tell me more about Richard's individual recovery. You know, what was his path like, and what were the things that you saw along the way that began to give you trust that it's real?
I think more than anything, it was that he was committed to recovery. He was absolutely committed to recovery. We both of us had resisted 12 steps. You know, you read all the books when we were trying to fix it at the beginning. And the problem with the books is they've got so many things that talk direct you to 12 step, well, certainly at that time. We didn't have faith, so we didn't think that was an option. And, you know, the idea of him being with a load of other addicts was just horrific to me. But once we'd been to Milton's intensive, we had to go to 12-step groups in Houston, and I went to the ISA group. And it just felt like community. So, you know, I think accepting that we needed community was huge, huge. So Richard got involved as well. And he became totally committed, even though for him it meant a big travel. We just made it a project, if you like. We educated ourselves. We were both pretty committed lifelong learners. We read books together. We read them out loud. We found out more. We realized that there was a far better load of information over in the US. So we kind of got involved in communities further afield as well. We did the Bravehearts mentoring right almost pretty early on, just to sort of be with other people. And those kind of things really made a difference. And I think that commitment went further because it was almost like he was committed to solving problems. You know, we very much, if we can't help it because we were both teachers, we used a lot of symbolism, and I brought our ugly man.
Oh, yes.
I think I've showed you before.
I love the ugly man. Yes.
Ugly man was our trauma symbol because we accepted he had trauma, I had trauma. And this dear old ugly man was on the table when we were having difficult conversations because it meant that we were both addressing the trauma. So we were on the same side. And I brought you his little, what he used to have in his pocket. It's a little heart that I had given him that he carried everywhere. And what was his, like, recovery sobriety wallet. And the first thing it says is no. And he's got... He's got the Serenity Prayer in there and photographs of me, the 12-step stuff, a little card I had given him, and a Buddhist monk, because he was very, very into, in the early days, the whole hungry ghost thing, the idea of addiction being a hungry ghost, yes. And that really helped him. And he had this guy inside his... bathroom cupboard, so he would open it when he was shaving in the morning because he had hated looking at himself because he hated himself so much. So the Buddhist monk was there to remind him, and he's got some you know, the steps he would take in order to fend off any triggers and that kind of thing. So, you know, but he did these things by himself, which I thought was great.
Yeah, that's wonderful. That's amazing to me. And how special for you to share those things with us. So that's his recovery. How did he support you in your healing process as well, though? Because I know he did that.
I think he made himself interested in it, although that improved over time. He wanted to support me in my triggers, and he did his best to actively make it his business to help me overcome my triggers. So one of the things that triggered me early on was all the cities and towns that we passed where he had acted out. And but you had to go on this motorway past all of those to get to anywhere virtually. So we would talk about it beforehand, you know, he would say, let's play some nice music, or do you want to do some crosswords while we're traveling? He would always say, how are we going to manage this? And in the end, those triggers just went away. He was almost willing to do anything for my safety. He recognized that was real. And he was very open and very transparent. I had access to his phone, to all the bank accounts, to all the... downloading the phone bills, everything, you know. I didn't particularly want them, but and we didn't use any accountability software. I didn't want to do that. If he couldn't do it on his own without having that kind of something to block him, then, you know, I didn't want to be the sex police. I didn't want any of that. I wanted it to be healthy. So we didn't do that. In fact, I was even resistant to boundaries when I learnt about them, because, you know, I didn't quite understand the position of boundaries then. And, you know, I had this kind of fairy tale image. We don't need boundaries. We that's okay. And we continued with the community. We got really involved in the 12-step stuff, both of us in the intergroups and giving talks in different places. It took us places. It helped us create some new memories, and that became an important part. And we shared a vision, and we used that vision. We kept using that vision to check in how we were going, so that we, you know, we weren't always looking back, because we'd accepted that the old marriage was dead. But we tried to look forward and say, okay, well, how much progress are we making? And that's a helpful thing to do. But the difficulty is we didn't keep pace with each other. You know, my recovery was quicker than Richard's in many ways. And we used to say it was like the tortoise and the hare. So I was the hare rushing on, and he was the tortoise that would just stop and go in his shell, you know. And I'd either have to go back and give him a kick, or just remind him that we needed to do a bit more than we were doing. And but he was good at initiating. He would initiate the check-ins. I mean, one of the things we'd had to do very, very early on is I recognised that Richard's trauma was so intense that we had to find a safe place to talk. And one of the things we did was we got a shed in the garden, which was quite a cosy shed, and we turned it into somewhere we could go and sit. We went there to do check-ins. We went there to do, we took our journals in there. We shared our journals. We used it to, we had a gratitude jar. We were trying to do all the things that came up in the 12 steps and use them to be helpful. And we did gratitudes on tear out diaries. You know, mine was something that was praising women, and his was, the one I got for him was a bit more insulting than that. It was an insult a day, I think, but it didn't matter. It was my bit of punishment. But we turned it over and wrote gratitudes, and also one thing that we would surrender. So we got used to that whole thing of higher power, even though we had no idea what our higher power was at that stage. He was very keen on, he was very curious. He was curious about who he really was. He'd lived externally, and he was having to slowly move to do the internally. And the work that he did on himself made me feel safe, even though I guess I was probably the director of recovery to start with, but never the controller. Right. But I had to give that up. I had to say, no, I'm detaching. You're on your own now, mate. It's time that you work out what you need and what you want, and we can talk about it when you're not sure. And that made a difference, because that was when he began to be able to tell his story with humility. And I was desperate. I wanted a little bit of machoism, you know, not just people pleasing, but also being able to tell his story with humility instead of, you know, the poor me thing.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Betrayal Recovery Radio, hosted by Dr. Jake Porter. If you value the content we've shared today, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review. This helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. For more resources, visit APSATS.org. That's APSATS.org.